Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we open our show with some major breaking news out of Washington, D.C., including reports from Public News Service on the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade and ending abortion rights, as well as an update on gun legislation moving forward in Congress. We'll also have highlights from the January 6th Commission hearings, where you'll hear from Justice Department officials and a Georgia election worker who say they were pressured by then-President Donald Trump to commit illegal acts. COVID-19 vaccines are now available in San Diego County for children and babies as young as 6 months of age. Also in our health report, 3 suspected cases of monkeypox have been identified in our region. On Crime Beat, a suspect is under arrest for a string of school burglaries across East County. An arrest has also been made of a suspect accused of robbing elderly women in Lemon Grove grocery stores. Plus, the sheriff is asking the public for help to locate a shooting suspect. A restraining order has been lifted against Lemon Grove Councilmember Leanna LeBaron. Find out why on today's show. County supervisors have gone to bat for Noah Homes, asking the state to boost funding for group homes caring for adults with developmental disabilities. Supervisors also moved closer to putting a ballot initiative on the ballot to legalize and tax cannabis businesses in the unincorporated areas, as well as consider a 16-point plan by Supervisor Joel Anderson to improve public safety and equitability for communities if the measure is approved by voters. On Green Scene, hear about plans for the San Vicente Corridor aimed at improving transportation in Lakeside, Santee, Poway, and Ramona. You'll also hear why public access at Loveland Reservoir is threatened and why the lake may soon be drained almost completely, much to the dismay of recreational visitors and fishermen. Then on sports, hear about the race across America with competitors who dashed through the Anza Borrego Desert along their cross-country route. The county has extended its deadline for microgrants for very small businesses, and we'll have details on today's show. And from California News Service, we'll have a report on efforts to add voter outreach funds into the state budget. And finally, we'll have a report on where to find 4th of July fireworks and festivities across San Diego's inland region. So stay tuned for the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, where East County matters.
This is a public news service daily newscast update. The Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. I'm Mike Clifford. The Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision today, overturned Roe v. Wade, the landmark ruling that established the constitutional right to an abortion in the U.S. in 1973. That from CNBC. They report the court's controversial but expected ruling gives individual states the power to set their own abortion laws without concern of running afoul of Roe, which for nearly half a century permitted abortions during the first 2 trimesters of pregnancy. CNBC reports Justice Samuel Alito, as expected, wrote the majority opinion that tossed out Roe. Alito joined by the other 5 conservatives on the high court, including Chief Justice John Roberts. CNBC notes almost half the states expected to outlaw or severely restrict abortion as a result of the decision.
At the 4th hearing by the January 6th Committee on the 2021 attack against the U.S. Capitol, Fulton County, Georgia election worker Ruby Freeman testified on the threats of violence she faced in the aftermath of the 2020 election.
Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States to target you? The President of the United States is supposed to represent every American, not to target one.
After the hearing, California Democratic Representative Adam Schiff praised Georgia and Arizona officials and election workers.
People got to see these courageous public servants, but also I'm glad they got to see the danger that the president's lies put elected officials in all around the country.
Republican Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney urged the U.S. Department of Justice to pay attention to the evidence the committee is presenting amid an ongoing debate over whether the committee should send a formal criminal referral to the department. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
3 Justice Department officials testify before the January 6th committee. Republican Adam Kinzinger questioned former acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donahue about Trump's plan to fire Jeffrey Rosen, the acting Attorney General, and install Jeffrey Clark, who was willing to use federal government powers to help overturn the 2020 election.
The president said, just say the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressmen. So, Mr. Donahue, that's a direct quote from President Trump, correct?
That's an exact quote from the president, yes.
Testimony also revealed at least 6 Republican lawmakers asked for a presidential pardon for their role in attempting to overturn election results, including Mo Brooks of Alabama, who defended the request, saying Democrats would abuse the judicial system.
The Food and Drug Administration could soon ban the manufacturing and the sale of menthol cigarettes. It's a move advocates say could have a positive impact on health, particularly in Black communities.
Executive Director of the Northeast Ohio Black Health Coalition, Ivanka Hall, explains that menthol tobacco products have a cool, smooth taste, making them more appealing and easier to use, especially among new tobacco users. She adds they also have a mild anesthetic effect that suppresses coughing.
Normally, when you are taking something into your lungs that should not be there, your body rejects it by coughing. Menthol allows you to take in the full poison of the tobacco by making sure that your body doesn't do what your body should do.
Research shows nearly 85% of non-Hispanic Black smokers use mentholated products, putting them at increased risk of smoking-related illnesses. Mary Sherman reporting.
This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service. Remember, and listener supported. We're heard on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform, and find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. Versus Wade. I'm Mike Clifford. The Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision today, overturned Roe v. Wade, the landmark ruling that established the constitutional right to an abortion in the U.S. in 1973. That from CNBC. They report the court's controversial but expected ruling gives individual states the power to set their own abortion laws without concern of running afoul of Roe, which for nearly half a century permitted abortions during the first 2 trimesters of pregnancy. CNBC reports Justice Samuel Alito, as expected, wrote the majority opinion that tossed out Roe. Alito joined by the other 5 conservatives on the high court, including Chief Justice John Roberts. CNBC notes almost half the states expected to outlaw or severely restrict abortion as a result of the decision. The Food and Drug Administration could soon ban the manufacturing and the sale of menthol cigarettes. It's a move advocates say could have a positive impact on health, particularly in Black communities.
Executive Director of the Northeast Ohio Black Health Coalition, Ivanka Hall, explains that menthol tobacco products have a cool, smooth taste, making them more appealing and easier to use, especially among new tobacco users. She adds they also have a mild anesthetic effect that suppresses coughing.
Normally, when you are taking something into your lungs that should not be there, your body rejects it by coughing. Menthol allows you to take in the full poison of the tobacco by making sure that your body doesn't do what your body should do.
Research shows nearly 85% of non-Hispanic Black smokers use mentholated products, putting them at increased risk of smoking-related illnesses. Mary Sherman reporting. The Biden administration met with big oil as it faces pressure over gas prices averaging nationally just under $5 a gallon. Both sides said the talks were constructive, but no solutions were reached. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm called for collaboration with the industry to strengthen the country's energy security for the long haul.
The only way out of these boom and bust cycles is to break that soul reliance, and that means diversifying our fuel sources by deploying clean energy.
The on-scene commander waited for radio and rifles. Then he waited for shields. Then he waited for SWAT.
Steve McCraw, director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, spoke to state officials during a Texas Senate committee hearing on Tuesday. He called the police response to the mass shooting in Uvalde an abject failure. The Senate, including 14 Republicans, voted to advance its bipartisan gun bill, which includes enhanced background checks for those younger than 21, funding for mental health and school safety, incentives for states to implement red flag laws, and limits on the boyfriend loophole. Democratic Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy.
This is a breakthrough. And more importantly, it's a bipartisan breakthrough.
This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service, member and listener supported. We're heard on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform, and find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This is John Tidwell with a health report. COVID-19 vaccines for children as young as 6 months of age have been approved by federal regulators. The vaccines will be available locally within days at medical facilities, including Rady Children's Hospital, which is now scheduling appointments, as well as at community clinics, pediatricians' offices, and some pharmacies. Parents have two vaccines to choose from for young children, Pfizer and Moderna. The vaccines for children this age are given in much smaller doses than for adults. The Pfizer vaccine would be given in 3 shots, each containing 1/10 of an adult dose. The first 2 doses would be given 3 weeks apart and the final shot at least 3 months later. The Moderna vaccine for kids under age 6 is a 2-dose series given about 4 weeks apart. Each Moderna dose contains 1/4 of an adult dose, more than the Pfizer vaccine, so the Moderna vaccine is more apt to include fever or other minor side effects, according to Dr. Celine Gounder, an infectious diseases specialist at Kaiser Health, Times of San Diego reports. The vaccines for babies and young children are given using smaller needles than for adults, usually on the leg. Dr. Howard Smart, chair of the Pediatrics Department of San Diego's Sharp-Reese-Steele Medical Group, says vaccinating children aged 6 months to 5 years will offer added protection to those around them, including very young siblings who are not eligible for vaccination and family members who may be at increased risk of serious illness. Dr. Wilma Wooten, San Diego County's public health officer, says some parents have been eagerly anticipating the COVID vaccine for their younger kids. They should make an appointment to get them vaccinated as soon as possible. It's important to start the vaccine series as soon as possible for children to be fully vaccinated before attending school or preschool in the fall. Not all pharmacies will offer the shots of all age groups. CVS Health will offer shots for children age 18 months and up, while Walmart and Rite Aid will offer them to those age 3 and older. The county has had a new surge of COVID cases, including more than 4,000 reported in the past week. But since many people now use home testing kits that are not reported to health officials, the actual rate may likely be higher.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you award-winning public interest local journalism.
This is Elijah McKee with the County of San Diego Health and Human Services Agency has identified 3 probable cases of monkeypox in our region. All 3 cases are in people who recently traveled internationally, though the most recent case appears unrelated to the first 2 cases. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says all 3 local patients are doing very well and are managing their symptoms in home isolation. She adds that most people who become infected experience mild to moderate symptoms, and the risk of contracting the monkeypox virus remains very low for the general population. The Centers for Disease Control has confirmed 113 cases of monkeypox in 20 states and the District of Columbia, including 24 cases in California, the highest number of any state. The 3 local cases are pending confirmation by the CDC. Human monkeypox, also known as HMPXV, is a viral infection that can spread through contact with body fluids, sores on the body of someone who has monkeypox, or through shared items, such as clothing or bedding, that have been contaminated with fluids from sores of a person with monkeypox. The disease can also spread between people through saliva, or respiratory droplets in a close setting, or through intimate contact, including sex. Customarily, monkeypox cases have occurred in travelers or residents from Western or Central Africa, where the disease is endemic. Since May of this year, monkeypox cases have been reported in several non-endemic countries, including the United States. No deaths have been reported. Symptoms of monkeypox are similar to those of smallpox, but milder. They include fever, chills, headache, muscle aches, backache, swollen lymph nodes, and fatigue. A rash usually develops within 1 to 3 days after the appearance of fever. The rash often begins on the face and then spreads to other parts of the body. Most people who develop monkeypox experience symptoms for 7 to 14 days after exposure, though some cases last as long as 3 or 4 weeks. Usually, patients recover without treatment. Monkeypox remains contagious and can be spread to others until all scabs have fallen off and a new layer of skin has formed. Anyone who thinks they may have symptoms of monkeypox, especially unusual rashes or lesions, should contact a healthcare provider right away. Cover the area of the rash with clothing, wear a mask, and avoid skin-to-skin or close contact with others until the symptoms are medically evaluated.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
Sheriff's deputies have arrested an 18-year-old man in connection with a string of school burglaries in East County. Over the past few months, numerous schools have been burglarized in the Alpine, Lakeside, and Santee areas. Several computers and tablets were stolen from the schools. Sergeant John West with the Sheriff's Department says the suspect used a nail gun to break windows and gain entry to the schools in most of the burglaries. After an investigation, detectives from the Alpine Sheriff's Station identified Adam McGill as the suspect in several of the burglaries. He was arrested June 15th at a home in Pine Valley, where several stolen items and multiple items of evidence from the burglaries were recovered, according to Sergeant West. McGill was arrested and booked into the San Diego Central Jail on commercial burglary charges. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Henry Migala. A suspect accused of robbing elderly victims inside grocery stores in Lemon Grove has been arrested thanks to the help from the public, says Detective Freddy Herrero at the Lemon Grove Sheriff's Substation. A man believed to be the suspect was seen in surveillance videos during 4 incidents from May of last year through May of this year. After entering the grocery stores, the suspect would follow elderly women while they shopped. He would then wait for his victims to become distracted, reach into their purses, and steal their wallets, Detective Herrero says. The suspect was arrested on June 10th after the Sheriff's Department sent a news release with the suspect's description. In a separate Lemon Grove case, San Diego County Crime Stoppers and investigators from the Lemon Grove Sheriff's Substation want the public's help in identifying and locating a suspect wanted in the shooting that occurred on June 1st, says Sergeant Zarno. Crime Stoppers is offering a reward of up to $1,000 for information leading to the suspect's arrest. Deputies responded to the reported shooting at the intersection of Broadway and Buena Vista Avenue around 7:45 p.m. and found a victim who had been shot in the leg. The suspect was seen running away on foot and getting on an Orange Line trolley headed towards the city of San Diego. He got off the trolley at the Encanto and 62nd Street trolley stop. The sheriff has released surveillance photos, which you can view at eastcountymagazine.org in the Crime Beat section. The suspect is a black man with long dark hair and cornrows. He has a medium build and was wearing a white shirt, black shorts, and black athletic shoes. If you have any information about the shooting, please call the Lemon Grove Sheriff's Substation at 619-596-1466. You can also call the Crime Stoppers Anonymous tip line at 888-580-8477 or visit sdcrimestoppers.org to submit a tip. This has been Henry Migala with East County Magazine's Crime Beat Report.
A judge has lifted a restraining order which had barred Lemon Grove Councilmember Liana LeBaron from her home due to her husband accusing her of assault. The order was ended after LeBaron's husband, Timothy Howell, told the judge that the couple had sorted matters out civilly. Judge Shireen Sharlick stated, I'm very pleased to hear it's been civil. I expect that to continue, the San Diego Union-Tribune reported last week. The judge added that the restraining order could be reinstated if needed. The order had prohibited LeBaron from going near her husband, their home, his vehicle, and their dog. LeBaron was arrested in April and released on bail. It is unclear whether she may still face any criminal actions. Her husband, an El Cajon police officer, alleged that LeBaron kicked, hit, and bit him, as well as verbally abusing him during an argument over increasing his life insurance. LeBaron says the abuse allegations are false and accused her husband of trying to portray himself as the victim rather than the aggressor during divorce proceedings, noting that he could lose his right to carry a gun or work as a police officer. The judge indicated she never saw any physical evidence of abuse, such as photos, but also said LeBaron did not provide a formal response to the accusations. It is unclear whether the couple has reconciled or is parting on amicable terms, though they exited the courthouse together after the hearing, according to the San Diego Union-Tribune. Earlier this year, the Lemon Grove City Council tabled a proposed resolution to censor LeBaron over allegedly harassing city staff. The city claimed some staffers had left the city as a result. However, the city failed to provide any evidence of this in response to repeated public records requests from East County Magazine and violated the state's public records laws by failing to respond. LeBaron denied harassing staff, but has acknowledged calling fellow council members and the mayor buffoons. LeBaron is not the only Lemon Grove City Council member recently accused of violence. Former Councilman David Arambula, who lost his re-election bid in 2020, faces a civil lawsuit alleging that he assaulted and injured Lemon Grove businessman Chris Williams during a meetup at Arambula's home, where Williams' application for a dispensary was discussed, according to Williams and a witness. Williams' suit against Arambula and the city is slated to be heard in court in early August. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Elijah McKee.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
A change in the state's funding formula threatens to force NOAA Homes in Spring Valley to evict 40% of the residents it houses, all with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Now San Diego County Supervisor Joel Anderson and Chairman Nathan Fletcher are joining forces to urge the state to change its policy. Both supervisors held a press conference with NOAA Homes on June 14th before presenting a motion to the Board of Supervisors to request modification to the state's reimbursement rates for all housing and services provided for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, or IDD. Approximately 100 people attended the press conference, held at Waterfront Park, to call on supervisors and state decision makers to increase funding for facilities such as NOAA Homes. The state's Department of Developmental Services submitted a rate study assessing community-based services for people with IDD in March 2019. But that was before the pandemic, and the study inexplicably omitted rate models for group homes with seven or more residents. The state relied on the study in boosting reimbursement rates to smaller facilities, but those with seven residents or more, such as NOAA Homes, have had reimbursements frozen at the old rates as of April 1st. NOAA Homes, in a press release, says facilities such as theirs are critically underfunded in California. NOAA Homes is one of the largest housing providers in San Diego for adults with developmental disabilities, but now its ability to provide housing for adults with conditions such as autism and Down syndrome is threatened. NOAA Homes also has the only memory care home in California, specifically serving adults with IDD who are suffering from Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. The facility is a globally recognized model that has served our community for over 39 years. The negative fiscal impact of the new state rates on NOAA Homes will be $1 million this fiscal year alone. NOAA Homes held a fundraiser recently and, thanks to donors and community supporters, was able to raise enough funding to cover the shortfall for this year, but the future remains at risk. Their model, which provides opportunities for their residents to live in group settings, provides lifelong housing in 10 homes for 90 adults with IDD, ranging from 23 to 72 years old. But under the new reimbursement rates established by the state, NOAA Homes would need to evict 40% of its residents to be eligible to receive higher reimbursement rates. Jen Moss, HR manager for NOAA Homes, told supervisors, "What our residents really enjoy and appreciate is that they live together in large homes. Everyone has a single or double room, but they live in a larger home together, so they can live together and eat together and share life together." Supervisors also heard from numerous residents of NOAA Homes, such as Tim Raymond. He said, "I live at NOAA Homes, and my house has 10 people in it. They are like family to me." Molly Nocon, CEO of Noah Homes, said Noah Homes has over 200 people on a waiting list wanting to get in, but there is currently no room. She added, "I have so many people calling me, saying they can't find a home for their adult son or daughter, and are worried what is going to happen to them when they are no longer alive." She said Noah Homes is a best practice model nationally due to its innovative housing solutions, and she voiced gratitude to Supervisors Anderson and Fletcher for, in her words, "working with us to right this wrong." Supervisors unanimously approved a motion to ask the state to increase funding to sustain operations for facilities like Noah Homes. Supervisor Anderson said he is proud to partner with Chairman Fletcher on a board letter calling on the state to continue meeting the needs of local residents with intellectual and developmental disabilities, adding, "I am lucky to have an organization like Noah Homes, who is one of San Diego's largest providers of housing to county residents with IDD, in my district, and am thankful for their support of this initiative. Now the future of Noah Homes and its vulnerable residents is up to state officials." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Elijah McKee.
As San Diego County supervisors move forward on legalizing cannabis sales, cultivation, and other cannabis businesses in the unincorporated parts of the county, the Board of Supervisors have approved a draft resolution for a ballot initiative to tax cannabis businesses in unincorporated areas. The measure will still need final board approval on June 28th before going before voters on the November ballot. Currently, there are only 5 legal cannabis dispensaries in the unincorporated areas, all grandfathered in when the prior Board of Supervisors outlawed cannabis sales. The new board majority includes advocates of legal cannabis as well as members who want to assure that the county will reap a share of any cannabis business revenues. The vote was 3-1 on June 15th, with Supervisor Jim Desmond opposed. Supervisor Nora Vargas was away at a National Association of Counties conference. Supervisor Desmond raised concern over the inequity of having all county voters decide whether to impose a tax on cannabis businesses only in the unincorporated areas. Even supervisors representing voters outside the unincorporated regions voiced concerns, but county staff explained that state law mandates this process. Chairman Nathan Fletcher called the actions to advance the socially equitable cannabis program a step toward a safe, legal cannabis regulation. Supervisors also voted unanimously to have staff report back on a proposal by Supervisor Joel Anderson aimed at reducing disproportionate impacts of legalizing cannabis businesses on unincorporated areas in the community. Anderson's plan includes 16 measures aimed at enhancing public safety, limiting locations of cannabis businesses, requiring education on cannabis negative impacts and drug interactions, and requiring funds from a cannabis tax to be used to benefit communities. Supervisor Anderson, in introducing his measures, noted that unincorporated communities already lack equity with regards to public safety, infrastructure, transit options, health, education, and economic opportunity compared to incorporated residents. He said if voters approve legal cannabis operations in the unincorporated areas, the needs of the communities impacted by the facilities deserve equal consideration as all other stakeholders. Anderson's measures would, among other things, keep cannabis facilities at least 1,000 feet away from parks, recreational facilities, places of worship, child care centers, public libraries, and residential care facilities. Ban billboard advertising for cannabis within 1,000 feet of sensitive use sites. Have a design checklist to discourage minors from trying to visit. Provide each community planning area with options such as limiting the number of indoor cannabis consumption lounges. Allow restrictions on cannabis events for issues such as noise control and safety concerns. Have requirements for employees and licensing similar to those for alcohol establishments. Use funds from cannabis taxes for education, community beautification, and other community-related benefits, and explore how to incentivize local ownership. Fund enforcement against illegal dispensaries and use minor decoy stings similar to those used to prevent alcohol sales to minors. consider enforcement penalties for violators that could include fines, temporary closure, or revoking permits. Develop an evidence-based marijuana prevention curriculum to be made available to local schools. And require warning signs in dispensaries about potential negative health impacts of combining cannabis with prescription drugs. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Sandag and Caltrans are seeking public input on their San Vicente Comprehensive Multimodal Corridor Plan, which will involve transportation improvements in the Lakeside, Santee, Poway, and Ramona communities. The goal of the project is to balance future transportation needs while also preserving existing rural and community characteristics, including the natural landscape of mountains, hills, valleys, lakes, and creeks. The deadline to comment on the plan has been extended to July 30th at the request of Supervisor Joel Anderson, who says the plan will significantly impact East County and he wants to be sure residents have ample time to voice their opinions. Specifically, the project aims to complement the ongoing Highway 94 improvements and explore the long-term strategies to improve roadway safety for all users, prioritize wildfire evacuation routes and emergency preparedness needs, ensure equitable access to business and outdoor recreational activities, including hiking, biking, and equestrian trails, and develop solutions that enhance wildlife connectivity as well as sustainability within tribal lands and East County communities. You can find a copy of the Vicente Comprehensive Multimodal Corridor Plan and details on how to submit comments on eastcountymagazine.org in our Green Scene section. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Henry Migala.
On the outskirts of Alpine lies something rare in East County, an exceptional opportunity for fishing and other recreation on land that is free for the public to access through an arrangement with the U.S. Forest Service. But Loveland Reservoir is just under 30% full these days. It provides water to National City and the South Bay Irrigation District via the Sweetwater Authority, the utility agency that owns and operates the water stored in Loveland. Now, however, lakeside recreation at Loveland Reservoir is at risk of disappearing. At a meeting on May 16th, the Sweetwater Authority outlined plans to decrease the water level to the dead pool level, meaning to only a fraction of 1% of the lake's capacity. Such an action would deplete the lion's share of Loveland's storage, creating a level that even the Water Authority could not continue to use. Over 100 vertical feet of the lake elevation would be cut, and its current surface area of 203 acres would be reduced to just 10 acres. San Diego County's water is costly, and surface water reserves are historically low, so Sweetwater Water Authority conducts transfers to reduce their ratepayers' costs, but at a tragic loss for fishing and recreational users at Loveland Reservoir. The most recent transfer in January sent 2.7 billion gallons of water through Loveland Dam and downstream 17 miles to Sweetwater Reservoir, dropping Loveland to the emergency pool level. The dead pool level would mean drawing off the rest of this emergency storage. Etched into the sides of the lake are marks of transfers like this one, visible in variations of color and vegetation, showing starkly just how far the water levels have fallen, and the lake is set to soon become little more than a mud puddle if Sweetwater proceeds with its plans. Loveland's neighbors and its avid angler community fear that Sweetwater Water Authority's priorities and openness to a dead pool water level will ruin their access, effectively terminating lakeside recreation. Those who love the lake, however, are willing to fight for it. One advocate, Russell Walsh, lives just up the hill from Loveland in Hamul. He's been spearheading community organizing to preserve the lake. He's compelled to fight for recreation at Loveland for the next generation's right to access it, he says. And he adds that some people come to the lake every day for fishing. East County Magazine visited Loveland Reservoir. Walsh told us, "We can't fold, we cannot quit. They want to change their water policy and kill recreation." Before focusing his time on advocating for Loveland, Walsh would fish the lake twice a week for carp and bass. He appreciates how the water supports protected habitats, such as for arroyo toads. The lake is also a resource for fighting fires in the area, and there are many of those, as well as providing paths for bike riding and hiking. Walsh has advocated for funding to repair the Sweetwater Dam in the past, and now, through a two-year-long campaign of meeting with representatives at the county, state, and federal levels, attending community planning group meetings, and speaking with people in the lake's parking lot, Walsh aims to stir a groundswell of support to preserve lakeside recreation access at Loveland. Last year, he says, Sweetwater voted to drain the lake below the emergency level without a feasibility study. He says, "I was telling them you can't do that. We have a legal fishing program. We have rights. The emergency pool is lower than the fishing pool." The feasibility study was completed by Gillingham Water Planning and Engineering, Inc. in November of 2020. The study recommended the dead pool idea that's now on the table, advising that Sweetwater transfer Loveland's remaining emergency storage water to Sweetwater Reservoir because Loveland's storage was no longer needed thanks to water security measures taken by the county. However, in September of 2020, when Sweetwater's Water Board unanimously voted for the recent transfer, that study was not completed yet. Walsh has found allies such as the Sierra Club. There are also others who aim to protect reservoir recreation in East County, such as Supervisor Joel Anderson, who has advocated for greater public access back in 2021. But Walsh has also learned the difficulties of engaging large institutional bodies. He says, "It's like I'm invisible." Carlos Quintero, the general manager of Sweetwater Water Authority since September, says he has no issue with recreation at the lake and asserts he only makes transfers based on need, but he stresses that his top priority is to those paying for the water downstream and making sure their needs are met. He met with Walsh in May, but says we're just on opposite sides of the issue. According to Walsh, Quintero is the first general manager at Sweetwater to even communicate openly with him. Sweetwater Water Authority is a joint powers authority originally founded in 1972, nearly 30 years after Loveland Lake was created. It's governed by a board of seven directors, chaired by Hector Martinez, and it serves about 200,000 people in the South Bay. Quintero says Sweetwater has rights over this water. "It's our customers' water," he insists. "We do support recreational activities, given the right conditions. We're not out there purposefully trying to prevent the community from using this." But, he adds, "our mission is pretty clear. We're entering a pretty tough period with the drought. Our reservoirs are pretty low as far as capacity. We try to work with everyone," Quintero adds, "but our main goal is to make sure our service area has adequate water." The large water transfer has put Loveland's fishing float completely out of commission. Facilitated by Sweetwater and funded by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, back in 2008, with a mission to provide a safe and stable fishing area, the float is now in the dirt, overgrown with weeds due to the low water level. Walsh has tried cleaning up the dock, but the brush just grows back as the water recedes further. According to him, it was supposed to be a 100-year lifetime product, and it's currently unusable after just 14 years with no intervention from HUD nor Sweetwater. Quintero, who has only headed up Sweetwater since September, defended the recent transfer further in a San Diego Reader article, stating, "The most cost-effective source of water for our customers comes from authority-owned reservoirs." Still, Walsh and other community members maintain that Sweetwater must factor in their right to recreation in its water policy, even if that means buying more water from the county. Walsh has submitted four Freedom of Information Act requests to the Forest Service, along with two Public Records Act requests to the state of California. He estimates he's sent about 40 inquiries to Sweetwater, with more record requests pending. He claims to have found evidence that the Forest Service is responsible for protecting recreation access at Loveland and holding Sweetwater accountable. What he found was a 25-year-old paper trail of the deal between Sweetwater Water Authority and the Forest Service that set up public access to the reservoir in the name of conservation, water storage, and public partnership. Quintero affirms there was a land swap where Sweetwater received land from the federal government. In return, Sweetwater issued an access easement to Loveland Reservoir. That 1997 easement identifies a shoreline fishing program. It's supposed to be administered from sunrise to sunset, as well as other protected activities such as birdwatching and hiking. To Walsh and other supporters, it is clear that the U.S. Forest Service should ensure that the easement is administered properly, since the federal agency is the public partner in the agreement. Walsh, however, found that the federal agency did act in this role in 2009 when it prioritized the public in a discussion about holiday closures at the lake. And yet, current Forest Service officials disagree that they are in any way connected to matters at the lake. In fact, they have maintained for years now that Sweetwater has full powers over running the lake and that the easement only outlines a maximum level of access. Some Forest Service officials even briefly considered quit claiming the easement back to the Sweetwater Water Authority, which would remove the Forest Service and even leave the door open for user fees to be imposed at the lake. Now, part of what makes Loveland Recreation so desirable is that it is free. Unlike the Water Authority's other reservoir, Sweetwater, which charges day fees for recreational visitors. In April 2021, Robert Hayar, then Descanso District Ranger of the Cleveland National Forest, wrote a letter to Walsh, which states that the U.S. Forest Service, quote, simply has no legal authority or jurisdiction in this matter, unquote. Hayar recommended that Walsh direct his efforts to Sweetwater Water Authority, insisting that it has sole jurisdiction in the matter. He concluded that the U.S. Forest Service considers this matter closed. Hayar's response was repeated by other Forest Service officials in response to Walsh's inquiries to Secretary Thomas Vilsack at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees the Forest Service. Now, in February of this year, Deputy Forester Sandra Watts wrote that the land agreement is non-binding and there is no mention of a minimum recreation pool in the agreement. Cleveland National Forest did not respond to East County Magazine's request for an interview or comments for our coverage on this important issue. But Walsh believes that any length of shoreline, by definition, requires water. Basically, they reinvented the intent of the easement, he scoffs. Contetto disagrees. He says, I think the easement is very general and you operate it based on the conditions. Prior to Walsh's advocacy, in this lead-up to the land swap's finalization, some stakeholders, including the California Department of Fish and Game and now retired manager of the San Diego City Lakes program, Jim Brown, were already voicing concern about the public taking a net loss in land ownership. Sweetwater's likelihood for fair and open management of the property was also among their concerns. The deal went through, and land known as Rancho Samacatuma was brought under federal conservation in exchange for a parcel at Loveland given to Sweetwater Water Authority, which wanted it to boost their water quality protection. The catch, though, was the recreation program outlined in the easement on that parcel that Walsh and the Lake community say is now being thrown out. Walsh had this to say of the Forest Service's argument, "You took 25 years to do a wealth transfer, and you're unreliable. You shouldn't be able to do land swaps anymore if this is the way you're going to handle it," he contends. Aside from fighting to preserve the water level, Walsh has led a battle with the Forest Service to restore sunrise-to-sunset access at Loveland Reservoir. The lake was closed completely due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Then it partially reopened, and in May, public access was restored from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. 7 days a week, but during much of the year, that's still long before sunset. Other actions of the last few years were reversed as well, like the return of an online page about the fishing program. Sweetwater Water Authority even promoted the outdoor recreation program during the quarantine imposed by COVID lockdowns. Still, Walsh and others are pushing for a permanent sunrise-to-sunset access year-round to accommodate working people, since early mornings and evenings are the best times for wildlife viewing and the coolest, least crowded hours. General Manager Quintero admits that the easement does provide that access should be from sunrise to sunset, but says patrolling the lake to be sure nobody's locked in takes time, so closure at 6 o'clock is needed due to limited resources and to protect employee safety. He insists that 12 hours of fishing provides plenty of opportunities for the community. But those who use the lake disagree. Walsh is gathering petition signatures of community members who want to see full sunrise to sunset access restored. Of course, the hours are pointless if the lake itself is drawn down to the dead pool level, which would eliminate both lakeside recreation and emergency water storage. Walsh formally invited Sweetwater Water Authority to a mediation regarding the shoreline, water level, and sunrise-to-sunset access at Loveland Reservoir, but the agency has declined to participate. He has also offered the same mediation to the current Descanso District Ranger, Scott Tangenberg, also to no avail. He hopes such an event could yield a new memorandum of understanding between Sweetwater Water Authority, the Forest Service, and the public. San Diego has dramatically increased its water storage capacity in recent years and is poised to launch the Pure Water program soon to recycle wastewater. So draining down a cherished reservoir may no longer even be necessary to meet our region's water needs. In an email sent to officials, Walsh concludes of the draining, "This is not connected to drought. This is about taking away much-needed therapeutic recreation from the veterans, low-income subsistence fishers, hikers, and families in our region for a one-time water grab and a mud pit at the foot of the Loveland Dam." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is John Tidwell with a sports report from East County Magazine. It's called one of the most brutal endurance events in the world. The Race Across America, a cycling event of over 3,000 miles from coast to coast, has found a home in Borrego Springs. Dozens of foreign countries were represented this year as testament to the prestige attached to becoming a winner or even finisher in this punishing test of endurance. Around 100 cyclists descended the perilous grade into Borrego Springs in mid-June, where uncharacteristically cool weather greeted them, with temperatures hovering in the upper 90s. The solo riders left the Oceanside Pier on July 14th, with the team competition starting on June 18th and never looked back. Teams are comprised of either 2, 4, or 8 riders. Many cities on wheels, with crew members including drivers, mechanics, massage therapists, and others, follow their riders like mother hens. The first solo casualty occurred near Blythe, where a cyclist conked out for lack of hydration. Sharon and Greg Hall are avid Race Across America fans and came out to cheer the cyclists from Mission Viejo. Their son was a past race van driver in 2017 and 2019 in this event. Unbelievably, the couple has been following the race since its inception in 1982, when only 4 riders competed, including San Diego County legend and early Ironman John Howard. The Bemmer team of 8 holds the world record and hails from California. Keith Kaur, their van driver, said, "The strong tailwinds are perfect for us." The race finishes in Sail Harbor, Maryland, and crosses the Colorado River, the Sonoran Desert, the Rocky Mountains, the Great Plains, the Mississippi River, and continues east through America's heartland to the East Coast. It's a trip down nostalgia lane and rife with emotion. Daniel Smichowski, an early Ironman still training in the scorching heat of Borrego Springs, says he got choked up when the first team rider blew into town like an old supersonic Concorde. He watched in awe as a Brazilian cyclist transferred the baton as he chased the leader. Smichowski sums up the event this way: "It was an unforgettable, indelible sight in our raw human condition on the flat, windy, hot desert floor. They came and they left in the blink of an eye, but the memories are etched in perpetuity."
The smallest of San Diego County's small businesses, from dog walkers to tutors, sidewalk vendors, and everything in between, now have more time to apply for a free $2,500 county grant. The deadline for micro-businesses hurt by COVID-19 to apply for the second round of $2,500 grants has been extended from June 24th to July 15th. The grants are partly funded by the California Office of the Small Business Advocate. The grants are being given out with a special emphasis on helping businesses run by people and groups that have historically faced barriers to obtaining capital, including women, minorities, veterans, limited English speakers, businesses in low to mid-income rural areas, and people without documentation. Microbusinesses can be eligible for a $2,500 grant if their business was started before December 31st, 2019, is the owner's primary source of revenue, and is currently operating or has a plan to reopen. The business must also have generated less than $50,000 in revenue in the 2019 tax year, must currently have 5 or fewer full-time employees, and had 5 or fewer full-time employees in 2019, 2020, and 2021. It has to have been significantly impacted by COVID-19, and it must have previously not received any grant money from the California Small Business COVID-19 Relief Grant Program. Grants are available in all 5 supervisorial districts. You can find the grant application on the county's Microbusiness COVID-19 Relief Grant Program webpage or directly at the Small Business Development Center's website. And we also have that posted in the business section on eastcountymagazine.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
As California's state budget negotiations intensify, pro-democracy groups are asking lawmakers to put more money into voter outreach to help increase voter turnout. Advocates are asking for $85 million annually for 3 years. Veronica Carizales with the nonprofit California Calls says direct contact with voters from trusted sources who speak their language really pays off.
By having regular conversations with everyday voters and reminding them to turn out to vote, we've seen an increase by anywhere from 5 to 15% of new and occasional voters by keeping them civically engaged and by reaching out to them.
In recent years, California started mailing ballots to all registered voters, and 15 counties began using centralized voting centers instead of local precincts to increase access to early voting. In addition, people on parole after a felony conviction now have the right to vote. But advocates say it's important to raise public awareness about expanded voting rights, especially among groups that are underrepresented in voter turnout, young people and people of color. Efrain Escobedo with the California Community Foundation says the legacy of past discrimination, from voter ID to language barriers, has depressed turnout in communities of color.
Well, we have put good policies in the books. What we haven't done is engage those communities to make sure that they understand that the system works differently, that we are encouraging them to vote, that they should trust the process.
Studies show the changes produced high voter turnout in November 2020, especially among people already likely to vote. But they also led to a wider gap in turnout between wealthier white voters and young voters and people of color. The legislature has until June 15th to pass a budget. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week. East County's most beloved Independence Day celebrations are back after a hiatus during the pandemic. Here are some of the fun and festive 4th of July activities in our inland region, including fireworks, a parade, a music festival, and much more. The Lake Murray Fireworks and Music Fest will be held at the Lake Murray Playground on the San Carlos side of Lake Murray from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., followed by fireworks over the lake at 9 o'clock. The festival includes live music by multiple bands, plus food, games, a scavenger hunt for kids, and more. For more information, you can visit lakemurrayfireworks.org. Arrive early for Julian's big 4th of July parade since Main Street shuts down at 9 a.m. Julian's 4th of July celebration starts at 10 a.m. with pre-parade activities including a flyover of 4 World War II Stearman biplanes, patriotic music on 3 stages, and more live entertainment. Then at 10:30, there's a pie-eating contest. A second flyover happens at noon with military training planes and the playing of the national anthem. The parade kicks off after the anthem with a giant American flag carried down Main Street. Visitors can cheer on the Marine Corps Color Guard, the Gold Drum and Bugle Corps, a mariachi, Continental de San Diego band, and marching bands from local schools. Antique cars, vintage tractors, belly dancers, World War II submariners, and comedy entries will also appear. And after the parade, the Julian Woman's Club has a historic quilt show and a raffle for a handmade quilt. From 1 to 5 p.m., a deep pit barbecue and dance will be held by the American Legion. And you can also shop at local merchants or take a buggy ride through this historic Gold Rush town. You can get more info at julianparade.com. The community of Crest in unincorporated El Cajon will host its 4th of July event from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. in Nancy Jane Park. That's located at 113 North Park Drive in El Cajon. This event includes fun for the whole family, including a craft fair, food, kids' games, live music, a costume contest, including a dog costume competition, super raffle, silent auction, and more. The Ramona Family Picnic and Fireworks Show, presented by the Ramona Chamber of Commerce, Ramona Rotary, and Ramona Kiwanis Clubs, includes a family picnic and fireworks show. It will be held on the back field at Olive Pierce Middle School, located on Hanson Road in Ramona. The picnic starts at 4 o'clock with fireworks at 9 p.m. Bring a blanket and lawn chairs to enjoy a celebration of our nation's birthday. You can get more information at RamonaEvents.com. Santee Salutes is held by the City of Santee, which invites you to celebrate our nation's 246th birthday from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Town Center Community Park in Santee. There is a fee for parking, and it has to be purchased in advance on the City's website. Parking is limited, so you should consider carpooling, biking, walking, or using a rideshare service. There's free parking at Costco, but no shuttle service this year. The Fun Zone opens at 2 o'clock and accepts cash only for rides. At 3:45, a flyover will be held by the San Diego Salute Formation Flying Team. Food vendors and the Riverwalk Grill open at 4, or you can bring your own picnic. A patriotic ceremony at 6 p.m. will be followed by an 80s All-Star Concert at 6:30 p.m. with a fireworks show at 9 p.m. And be aware that barbecues, glass containers, and hard liquor are prohibited at this event. For full details, you can visit cityofsantee.gov. One of our Inland Region's largest Independence Day celebrations takes place at Old Poway Park on Midland Road in Poway. The old-fashioned 4th of July, held from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., celebrates our country's independence in turn-of-the-20th-century style. This event will feature patriotic entertainment, Western reenactors, model train displays, free crafts, and old-fashioned games. You can ride aboard a historic train or enjoy tasty treats. There are shuttles to and from the event available from two different locations, including the Poway City Hall parking lot and Poway Adult School parking lot. Shuttles will run throughout the event. You can get more information and photos of past events at poway.org. Click on the old-fashioned 4th of July tab. The City of El Cajon hosts its annual fireworks show at Kennedy Park on East Madison Avenue in El Cajon. The fireworks starts at 9 p.m. You can arrive early and bring a picnic in the park, which also includes a dog park. You can get more at elcajon.gov. The City of Escondido is bringing back its free professional fireworks show to celebrate Independence Day. However, there will not be the traditional large-scale event, only fireworks. And the show starts at 9. The community is welcome to enjoy the fireworks show from anywhere in central Escondido, including Grape Day Park. Fireworks will be launched from a location in the Woodward Avenue parking lot. Grape Day Park will be open past dusk with traditional regulations in place. No dogs, barbecues, or alcohol are allowed. You can get more information at escondido.org and click on the Independence Day Celebration tab. You can also enjoy a San Diego 4th of July parade and festival at Scripps Ranch. Community groups, high school marching bands, and more will entertain you as you watch the parade. Afterwards, you can enjoy ice cream at an ice cream social in Hoyt Park. Food, drink, and games are available at the festival. The parade starts at 10 a.m. at Ironwood Red Cedar Drive, proceeding to Ironwood Road, to Courtyard Drive, to Red Rock Drive, to Scripps Ranch Boulevard, ending in Avery Drive. The festival runs from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. in Scripps Ranch Hoyt Park. For more information about the Scripps Ranch 4th of July Parade and Festival, you can visit scrippsranch.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. East County Magazine has won over 137 major journalism awards. With reporting that's making a positive difference in our region, the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ covers important topics such as fire protection, energy and environmental issues, stories from East County's Native American and Chaldean communities, rural issues, and helping local veterans. Please help keep the East County Magazine show on KNSJ by donating or making a sustaining monthly pledge at www.knsj.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you award-winning public interest local journalism.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Bueco, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.